It's time for Valley Edition, a weekly panel discussion on current issues in the Mat-Su Valley, moderated by Mike Malevsky.
It's time once again for another edition of Valley Edition, and I'm welcoming on the phone Zas Hollander. Welcome, Zas.
Hey, Mike. It's great to be here.
And Zas, you have covered a lot of topics and stories over this year to this point. And it's a bit early for us to go on and say, hey, you know, what were the memorable stories of time. I'm thinking that today what we may want to do is just look at some of the issues or stories that have persisted, that were at the beginning of the year active, being written about, and there's a lot of discussion going, and they've continued. So I have a couple of them in mind, but I'm wondering if you have any you want to start with, or do you want me to throw out a few?
No, I think that there is the kind of unfortunate, the Grunwald murder case and the trials that are ongoing in that case. You know, David Grunwald was murdered in November 2016, so 2 years ago, and there, you know, are four out of five defendants in that case charged with murder, and one of them has gone through trial and been convicted, and now the next defendant is set for trial. It sounds like opening arguments may begin the Monday after Thanksgiving, so not for a little while yet. It's proving very difficult to seat a jury the second time around in what was already a high-profile case. And, you know, most murder trials do take a while to get through the judicial process, but this one is very complicated and has a number of defendants who are not joined. And so it's proving to be very, very time-consuming, which isn't easy on anybody, including, the parents and friends of David Grunwald and the defendants and their families as well.
And that's a good point to make, that very often an event happens. It may be the death of someone, a murder, and it happens in a moment. There's a lot of focused attention. And then it doesn't necessarily go away, certainly not for the victim's families and so on, or the alleged perpetrator. But you're pointing to something that has literally gone on for 2 years, and pops up, and typically when there's some judicial action that's taken. I think that's a good example of a case that requires maybe revisiting from time to time, because in the moment when a story is being written, we know a certain amount of information, and as time goes on, we get more, certainly as it's revealed in trials. I'm thinking, since you've thrown that one out, I'm thinking about another issue which is very, very different, but has had a torturous path as well, and this is timber, the timber exploration and the timber process of cutting, selling, etc. And that's something you have also paid a little bit of attention to, and primarily involves both the borough's port as well as a large swath of land in the northern part of the valley.
Yeah, that's the large kind of business venture that at its center has a timber sale on borough land called the Chijuk Creek Timber Sale, which emerged from a settlement of a legal dispute from an original timber sale, 10 years old now,
right,
or more, Charlie Nash. And so, the some assembly members in approving this venture voiced some concern that this is a project that they're heading into that already has kind of a checkered history. But this venture not only, you know, roped in a large timber sale, which we haven't seen on borough land in some time, but what was estimated to be, you know, $1 million a year at the port, and a lease at the port that would, you know, bring in finances and much, much needed revenues for a port that's, you know, $1 million plus in the red, if I remember right, every year. but and almost entirely unused at this point, but also could be generating jobs at the port, but also among private contractors who were working the timber deal. And just, you know, it really was a kind of an all the eggs in one basket, and did sort of seem too good to be true. And unfortunately, sure enough, it sounds as if, at least on the surface, the trade tariffs with China have made the project unpalatable at this point to go forward. So the whole project is on hold. There's no logging going on. And at this point, the whole thing is in limbo.
Since we've segued over into thinking about large projects of economic development, there are two others that are kind of interesting, and there's a spinoff from the results of the election that just happened. We'll talk about that separately. But I'm thinking about the LNG line as well as the Donlin Gold Project, which involves, interestingly enough, the Matsuburo in particular in providing a gas line to that mine. And I just read a piece by Tim Bradner today, which was kind of an interesting one, that said that basically as the new governor, Dunleavy, takes over, he has appointed a former governor, Sean Parnell, to take a look at what had been a centerpiece of the Walker administration's development, economic development. And it turns out that Sean Parnell, of course, had a lot to do with the original construction of the idea of such a pipeline and is well-versed in the detail. But the real question comes, does it pencil out where the state of Alaska, which seems to be the contention, will the state of Alaska take on a responsibility for a portion of this funding so as to allow the project to go forward? And we're talking about LNG and kind of arrangements with China, et cetera, but also the gas line to provide gas to a power plant for the Donlin mine involves a kind of a similar thing. And the reference that has been made to the Red Dog mine, where people may have forgotten that the Red Dog mine seems to have proven itself as an economic power point in that region, both for the company that operates it and the communities around. But it was the state that built the road through AIDEA to actually make it possible. So that's one example of state involvement with a private, it's kind of a private-public mm-hmm. cooperation that actually worked.
Yeah, and Parnell was a huge champion of the what was called the Roads to Resources program during his administration.
Right. So we have that continuing on because there's still big questions, apparently, because we can look to the national level involvement with the concerns about the relationship between the U.S. and China over tariffs, et cetera, and whether the Chinese will be willing to sign off on some contracts for Alaska Gas. So that's still in play. It remains going. Now, we mentioned the election, and obviously that went through the entire year. And as right this moment, there are still some questions about the results of the election. The two lingering races were in the Fairbanks area. And as we're speaking now, my understanding is Scott Kawasaki appears to have a lead over the incumbent, Pete Kelly, who's also been Alaska State Senate president, that probably will not be surmounted. And I'm not so much aware of the details of the House race, but those two results can change a lot of things in the Alaska State Legislature coming up.
Yeah, certainly. And Representative David Eastman is still hedging his bets as well in terms of caucus joining or not.
And I looked at the numbers and I had and realized, but and we've mentioned this in the past, but it's possible at this point to see a 20-20 split in the House, or for that matter, one or another of the people, David Eastman or others, not necessarily going along with the Republican plan for running the House. Over in the Senate, I was reminded of what a large advantage Republican senators have. Should Scott Kawasaki win that race, I think it's going to be 14-6. That's pretty formidable. But what it does do is kind of send a message when a very powerful senator who has had dramatic impacts upon legislation in the form of Pete Kelly's work is defeated. So, So we have all of those things happening. And, of course, we should mention, I think, that after all of the drama associated with the governor's race, in particular Governor Walker stepping aside in favor of Mark Begich, Michael Dunleavy did still win. He won pretty easily, one would say. But I was particularly taken by an article that Ivan Moore wrote recently, and it appeared in the Anchorage Daily News. Did you have a chance to look at that by any?
No, I haven't seen that.
I would commend it to you, because Ivan Moore, for those listeners who are not aware, is probably one of the most mentioned pollsters, surveymeisters, in the state of Alaska. And if we look out to another prominent figure in the surveying and polling world, at 538, we find that Alaska is often referenced as a place where there isn't a lot of polling done. Mr. Moore probably would take offense at that by saying that we do pretty good polls. And in his article, he reminds that back in the day when Fran Ulmer was running for governor, she was in the lead for a good portion of the time. And then as it got very, very close, things changed. And the result was that Frank Murkowski became governor. But what he points out is that you can't take one poll and hold it and not look at subsequent polls and surveys. And I think that's the kind of thing that many people suggest is important. No matter what the poll is at a moment in time, if you look at the way the trend line is moving, you can see that you uncover people's ideas of who they're going to vote for, and then you see a shift very often happen. Ivan Moore, in particular, said there's a large group of Republican voters that sort of emerge at the last moment, and that has happened consistently over the years, and perhaps that's the reason why Mr. Dunleavy, as well as Alice Galvin, lost their races this year.
I think there certainly was a lot of frenzy, if that's the right word for it, but a lot of attention given certainly to Elise Galvin. She had a very energetic campaign, and such a kind of a stark difference between her campaign and Donald Brown's campaign. But that was still a long shot given his incredible tenure.
Right. There are two other stories that I have in mind that also fit into this discussion, I think. One involves Denali, and in particular, the various air services that have supported Denali. And what I understand is still a continuing contention about ownership of a lodge that sits high up on the mountain. Do you have any recent information about that discussion?
Nope. I'm sure they are filling it nicely up there at its lovely perch on the mountain.
Okay. And the next topic is one that has appeared on the front page of the Anchorage Daily News recently, and that is, it's all about a napkin, apparently. The front page carried a napkin where there was something sketched out about a ownership or business proposal that involved the Anchorage Daily News. Have you come back to see any of that happening? Because I think they're still...
It's still ongoing in Anchorage. It's not something I'm covering, but it's the court case between Alice Rogoff, the former owner of Alaska Dispatch and Alaska Dispatch News, and Tony Hotfinger, who was a co-founder of Alaska Dispatch and a former Anchorage Daily News reporter from, boy, when's Tony hired? Late 90s, I want to say.
Okay.
It's, I mean, for someone who works for the newspaper, it's a kind of a painful path to watch. But this is the case in which Hotfinger, Tony is arguing that Alice Rogoff owes him, I think it was $100,000 over a 10-year period, her, to buy out his share in the newspaper that he and his ex-wife, Amanda Coyne, founded and obviously had a creative stake in and had a tremendous financial stake in. And Alice Rogoff is arguing that that's not the case and that she does not owe him what he says she does. But, we are having it's a difficult business to be in on any good day, and so it's more difficult to watch the past play out in a legal setting.
Right. Now, what we have also done is had a continuing scattering of a variety of accidents on roads, both up the Parks Highway in Anchorage and throughout the valley here. You've covered some of those. You've reported about them. Am I just more sensitive to the fact that they're happening? It just seems that almost every other day there is an accident of one sort or another. Are we become busier on the roads, or the roads becoming worse, or any comment about that?
Well, I mean, clearly our population continues to grow, and then about a third of us here in Mattsu continue to commute to Anchorage, and so a third of a growing population is equals more drivers on the road. Depending on where the accidents are happening, there's a great deal of congestion on Kinnick Goose Bay. There have been some delays in improvements on that road, which is a terrible road to drive. I think anybody who drives that road, the combination of poor sight lines, two lanes, and for whatever reason, it seems like a higher percentage of driveways, unsignaled roads, and really aggressive drivers. Maybe it's just because we're all funneled into the same two lanes, but it's I don't think anybody enjoys driving KGB. So we've also had more kind of warmer, icier weather lately, which is a much trickier driving situation than just good old snow.
Right. Well, speaking of snow, there was some joy in Musherland as the snow came down, and people, for at least a brief moment, and in some areas continue to be able to begin training for the Iditarod. We've had some discussions about the Iditarod. We have a show, Robert Forto does Mushy Radio, and he does interviews, and he looks interviews with mushers, and he looks at rule changes and such that happen with the Iditarod and other long races. It appears at this moment that while the Iditarod is on its way to be happening again next year, there is a little slow joining, people throwing their fur hats in the ring to do that. Have you picked up anything in terms of other suggestions around factors that might limit the Iditarod field this year?
Boy, I haven't heard a lot about that quite yet. I think that the most recent news surrounding Iditarod was the Barrington dog team that was hit by a car on KGB.
Right.
After somebody got rear-ended and rolled into a ditch where there was a team of dogs going by. It sounds like Musher and dogs are injured, but nobody hurt badly as far as I know.
Okay.
Thank goodness.
Right. Got it. Any last topics you'd like to touch upon before we finish up, Zaz?
Well, I mean, clearly the weirdly warm weather that persisted through the fall is continuing through this El Nino winter, and the Mattsu Burrows malware attack is still,
oh, yes.
I think there's still some residuals in there.
We saved the worst for last, right? There was a meeting recently, a Smart Communities meeting at the Borough. They happen quarterly, alternating with a large number of people involved in data systems, meeting in Anchorage and then out here. And Eric Wyatt, the IT director for the Borough, did give an update. He's been very, very available to point out the realities of what's happening. from an Anchorage Assembly standpoint, there has been expressed concern about the costs. People, I don't think, fully understood before this happened how significant an interruption to service and how many dollars would be spent to bring in additional people to actually fix things, how incredible the effort to fix all computers, and also to, as Eric points out, buy some of the equipment and software, et cetera, that will make this less likely to happen in the future. I think there's, particularly for bodies that are looking at a budget, a willingness to understand and say, yes, we understand that we need to be protected. But when a dollar figure is looked at, you say, well, can you put that off for a little while? I'm not suggesting that the putting off for a little while made the borough more vulnerable. But I think perhaps what we've done is enter a new world where this kind of thing is more likely to happen. So any operation has to up its game. With that, I think we're done, Zas. I really appreciate your willingness to call in and walk through memory lane a bit, pointing out things that will continue to be under discussion as we move forward.
Yep, the year is young yet, Mike. I'm sure there's more to come.
Oh, yes, we haven't finished it at all. Well, thank you, Zas Hollander, for calling in, and we'll be back next week with another edition of Valley Edition.
You've been listening to Valley Edition, a weekly panel discussion on current issues in the Matsu Valley, moderated by Mike Malevsky. Valley Edition is a production of Radio Free Palmer, recorded at our studios in Palmer, Alaska. The views and opinions of hosts or guests do not necessarily represent those of Radio Free Palmer, this station, or its underwriters. If you have any comments or questions about this program, email manager@radiofreepalmer.org.